Listen, we're looking at the major agencies of the Counter-Reformation. We look at the history of Protestantism as it went through the various countries of Europe. Now we're looking at how the Roman Catholic Church reacted to the Protestant Revolution. The major agencies we've indicated were the Council of Trent, the Inquisition, the Index, and now we come to the most important agency of the Counter-Reformation. The Roman Catholic Counter-Reformation is the formation of the Society of Jesus. Now, you've learned, have you not, that this is not that the formation of a new order in the Roman Catholic Church, that was not novel in and of itself. We've already studied the formation of many orders, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Augustinians, the Capuchins, all kinds of orders, but this was a new order that was different. Its purpose was to fight Protestantism. And I might say it did it very effectively. The order became and has remained the most important and powerful order of the Roman Catholic Church. We're going to see that at one time in its history, it became so powerful that the Pope outlawed it, believe it or not. You heard it first here. It became more powerful than the papacy. It controlled the papacy. It controls education. The Society of Jesus controlled the Roman Catholic Church. Now, there are several most Catholic universities are Jesuit, or Society of Jesus. Its founder, Ignatius Loyola, he was a Spaniard. We're not surprised at that. Where did the Inquisition begin? Spain. What was the most Catholic country? Spain. Spain was more Catholic in the theological sense than Italy was. You often have a king of Spain who's more Catholic than the Pope. And that is when you had the Renaissance popes, where the popes were not really Christians, even in the historical sense. They were classical humanists. We call that the popes of the Avignon papacy last quarter. The popes, they were interested in Plato, not Jesus. Even during that period, you had emperor kings and noblemen in Spain who were devoutly Roman Catholic. So we're not surprised to find the beginning in Spain. He was of noble birth, he grew up to a military career, and this is the key to understanding Loyola and the order that he founded, the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits. It is a military order. It is the creation of a system, a religious system, based on the military paradigm, on the military model. We're going to find something similar to this later, we're going to study this when we come to it, is the Salvation Army. No, the Salvation Army doesn't have bishops, it has captains. And we don't do so much anymore, but the time was, and they wore uniforms. It's a militaristic order and the head of their group was General Booth. So that's an example of the Methodist, and come to that later. But what I'm trying to teach you here is that this happens down to, this is not a unique thing where you set up a religious order on the military model. He followed the fading code of knighthood and chivalry. That is, he was, remember we talked about this last quarter, the knight who defends the lady and he fights for truth and justice, he never lies, and he goes out and fights the dragons, or the enemy, whatever, whoever the enemy is. Well, he Loyola founded a military order, religious order, after the military pattern, sort of Christian knights. Knight, that is to defend, to fight for the cross, for the church, as he understood. He himself had fought, and was wounded in battle, he limped all the rest of his life. All the years he was so active in forming the order, he limped from an old wound. He was profoundly influenced by Thomas Aquinas, The Imitation of Christ. It's a spelling of Aquinas, men correctly in their syllabus. Kempis, error in their syllabus. You recall that was one of the most influential books. It's a pietistic book. And it's mystical. We've studied that. He expanded this mystical approach to religion, to asceticism, and mendicancy. That's misspelled too. Mendicancy, to be A and C, right at the end of the word. That is, these were mystical mysticism is a very intense form of faith. Not always an accurate form of faith, but a very intense form of faith. To show you how serious he was, as a grown man, he attended school in Barcelona with children to catch up on his education. Can you picture this? When we think about his education, he was a fighter, he was a knight, and he became profoundly influenced for Christ, as he understood him. And so he realized he needed an education, and so he went to school, this is a church school, and sat with the kids. Here's this war veterans, or wounded in battle, sitting down with the children to learn the basics and go on. And eventually we see him at the University of Paris. He was there when John Calvin was there. Well, this is similar to this. Remember this lady has the school in Chicago. What's her name? They made a TV movie about it. Where she teaches disadvantaged kids. Doesn't teach them the old method. What's her name? But anyway, remember this basketball player who graduated from a major college with a basketball scholarship. Couldn't read and write. This black player went back to school. Except there, he was about 6'7". You know. Guys paid through a scholarship, didn't make the pros, was illiterate, college degree. And so he went back to school. Remember this? This was dramatized on television. It's about 4 or 5 years ago. And he sat there with the kids. There's a 6'7" player sitting there in the back row, learning how to read and write.
Well, that was Loyola.
At the university, he conceived a new order of Christian knights pursuing a chivalry based on devotion to Mary as the object of all pure affection. As the medieval knight would go forth in conquest for his secret love, secret lady, so he would have Christian knights go forth to do spiritual battle on behalf of the Virgin Mary. And some of the ablest men at the university joined him. He formed the order, he persuaded them. Let me say that before I leave that point. The Jesuits have always been extremely able men. The average Jesuit has a PhD and beyond. They are the most, by far the most highly educated order, and they are the educators of the Roman Catholic Church. We speak of higher education. And now keep in mind what it was, what the Jesuits have done. And he said, so you get men who are single, first of all, not, can't be married. And they are financed by the church. Their education is financed. So they sifted the men. They picked the men, they've always done this, high stability, given them an education, or a fine education, and turned them into real crusaders for the church. Here are the distinguished, and the Pope sanctioned the order. I list here on page 84 the distinctive characteristics of the Society of Jesus. I've already indicated the first one. The second is, they followed a strict military discipline. Loyola wrote the order of discipline called the spiritual exercises. And in this spiritual exercise, is set forth the code of obedience. That is, obedience to who? To whoever your superior is. Ultimately the Pope, but the superior in the order. Martin Luther's superior in the Augustinian monastery there in Wittenberg, Saxony. This is the order, this is the superiors. Look at this. Let me read this with you. This gives us the spirit of the Jesuits. Let us with the utmost pain strain every nerve of our strength to exhibit this virtue of obedience. Firstly, to the highest pontiff as the Pope, then to the superiors of the society, so that in all things to which obedience can be extended with charity, we may be most ready to obey his voice, just as if it issued from Christ our Lord. When the man above you in the order gives you an order, it's Jesus speaking. Leaving any work, even a letter that we have begun and have not yet finished. We're writing a letter. Right in the middle of the sentence. And the order sends you to Japan, you don't even finish the sentence. You just automatically get out and go. by persuading ourselves that all things, that is all things good, are just. Ours is not to question why, ours is but to do or die. By rejecting with a kind of blind obedience all opposing opinion or judgment of our own. Listen, look at that. Think about that. No matter what, if you order it, if your superior says to do it, we assume that it's right, no matter what it is. I'll come back to that. We do not use our own judgment. Let each one persuade himself that they live under obedience, that they that live under obedience ought to allow themselves to be born and ruled by divine providence working through their superiors exactly as if they were a corpse. It's like you put a corpse over your shoulder or in a box and carry it around, so we are carried around by the authority of our superiors. It suffers itself to be born and handled in any way whatsoever. And just as an old man's cane, which serves him who holds it in his hand, wherever it, whatever purpose he wishes to use it, or like the cane a man has in his hand, to use at the will of our superiors. Well, let me think about that. It's kind of scary, isn't it?
Wasn't there a desire of Jesus in the time of the gospel of the living? There was not a glorified of Jesus in his
judgment. Now, are you saying there was another group that called themselves that?
Yeah.
There was a group of fanatical followers at that point in time, there wasn't there?
Jesus?
I don't think it was called that, but I think I know what you're talking about. There were, I think there was. I heard something along that line.
There's
just
me. That's what says, because
news to me, too.
I've heard
of
it. Okay. Now. Well, we can see where this will lead. Let me come back to that. They were free from all previous monastic restraints. That is, if they were men who had taken vows, say the Dominicans, or in another order, they were free of those vows automatically. They became a member of the Society of Jesus. They were free to go anywhere they were sent, to wear whatever clothes were expedient. They didn't have to wear clerical garb if it was not expedient. They were free from the requirements of spending so much time in prescribed devotions. The other orders spent so many hours a day, the seven watches, and seven times a day, or seven times in a 24-hour period, spend a long time, spend 45 minutes in prayer, and have to do that. Free to work. So this is very pragmatic, is it not? You know, whereas other orders were assigned particular tasks, the Jesuits are free to do whatever the church needs, and that's just a superior command. They grew rapidly, this is very attractive, they attacked it. They became so powerful, even the Pope was afraid of the order and suppressed it for a time. 1750, of course, said that. At certain periods of time, they were expelled from French or Spanish domains. Now think about this, you guys. Why would the Pope himself be afraid of them at various times? The king would be afraid of them. Because, in the very nature of things, no matter what ideas are being espoused, no matter whether it's true or false or whatever religion it is, if you put together an organization that has two qualities, number one, high ability, men of, there are really three qualities, men who are highly able, well educated, and free of encumbrances, you know, no families. Secondly, men who are devout. And third, men who take an oath of absolute obedience. And just think about that combination. Think of the power that gives to whoever's in charge of those men. It's like a Delta Force almost. You know what a Delta Force is in the military? They're the ones we got a fellow in our church who's an army, he's a retired army officer. He used to tell us about the Delta Force. The Delta Force is as it operated in Vietnam. But those fellows, they were trained assassins. They were, and they would be dropped behind enemy lines for 6 weeks at a time, and they're total armed. They had to be armed with a knife. Had to move fast, couldn't carry weapons. They got weapons right. They just improvised as they went along. They lived off the land, improvised.
And those fellows will be brought behind the lines, and 6 weeks later, they would be taken out, arrested, and then be brought behind the lines again with a knife.
Rambo.
Yeah, like Rambo, even not Hollywood-ish. And those guys would, they would improvise and steal weapons and, you know, and offer, and were successful. But you couldn't believe guys that were that trained, you know, they were so extremely well, a very select group, and extremely well trained and very dangerous. But you imagine, if you get a hold of it, convert that kind of spirit and ability to any cause, whoever's in charge of that, those people have tremendous power. More power sometimes than a pope. More power than a king. And it's a very large order. Well, what were the methods of the Jesuits? They began by emphasizing works of charity. That was changed later. They were given, believe it or not, to preaching. It was the Jesuits who preached. You recall that Roman Catholic preaching, as we know it, except in the Middle Ages,
are you all two children?
Preaching, as we know it, as we think of it, had died out in the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church, with a few exceptions of men like St. Francis, who were the exception. Martin, it was the Protestants who re-established and restored preaching, and so the Jesuits, in reaction to the Protestant preaching, they restored Roman Catholic preaching. There is more Roman Catholic, there is more preaching, as we think of it, in the Roman Catholic Church today than there was in the Middle Ages because of the reaction of Protestants. And as the Roman Catholics preach now, some because the Protestants preach. That is historical, that's been true, and that is why they restored it. And it was the Jesuits who were the preachers. And they reclaimed many Protestant areas back simply by open-air preaching. They were the Protestants. Keep in mind that many of the common people had not picked up on all the niceties of Protestant theology. And they were restored back simply by persuasion. Third, formal education, especially the young children. Most Catholic colleges and universities, as I said, are under the Jesuits. When did the Roman Catholics, where did the idea of parochial schools come from? Came from the Jesuits in reaction to the Protestants. You recall that there was no education of children of any kind, just about in the Middle Ages. Who started educating the children? Martin Luther. Remember the small catechism? For the children. And since the Protestants were now educating their children, the Catholics, under the leadership of the Jesuits, started educating children. That's when it began. And the Roman Catholic parochial school system, as I say, came from the Jesuit movement.
And it's been very powerful.
It's interesting. When I was a little boy, the Protestants traditionally looked down on Roman Catholic schools, the parochial schools. And now, because of the nature of society, the Protestants are building Christian schools. Public schools like basic were forced into it. The whole view has changed. Parochial schools, because what I'm saying is this, when I was a little boy, because parochial schools, this was a Roman Catholic practice. It was automatically rejected by Protestants. But now that's been flip flopped. It's interesting, it's how good, but the Roman Catholics did it because the Protestants originally did it. But you understand. That only until very recent time was there anything what we would call public education. It's very recent in history. For all religion, all education is private. Okay. The confessional became the agency for the manipulation of the conscience. The confessional, at what point does the Roman Catholic Church have the most control over its people? The answer is in the confessional. Why? Well, because the confessional, I've already said, is where people gain absolution. The Roman Catholic gains absolution and learn what his penance is, where he maintains contact with the benefits of the cross according to Roman Catholic theology. And the Jesuits, now hear me, because, as I say in the syllabus, because the Jesuits were so better educated as a class, they were superior people, the kings often, not just kings, but the nobility often were the Jesuits to be their confessor. They didn't want some illiterate monk and priest, you know, with halitosis and ring around the collar, being their confessor. It's like know, sometimes large churches, they want their preacher to have advanced degrees and be sophisticated. You may not be able to preach worth shooting, but you know, the idea of it. Y'all get, so that's sort of a snobbery. And so, because so many of the up-the-ups wanted Jesuits to be their confessor, Jesuit priests, because they were the best educated, were worthy of them. And because the confessional is such is a place where there is such control, the Jesuits actually got in control of a lot of the nobility of Europe because they were their confessors. Y'all see that? That is, they could tell the nobility what to do, and often what they were told to do was what the Jesuits, was, that was helped the Roman Catholic position in general, or the Jesuit position in particular. However, this thing, as you might guess, caught up with it. They were brought into disrepute because they leaned toward the questionable ethic that the end justifies the means. You ever heard that phrase? The end justifies the means? That came from the Jesuits. And it did not, the original form of it was, the end sanctifies the means. Now listen to me. You can see why they came by Moody's beard. If you say that the end sanctifies the means, then you have that the ethic of a group of powerful people. That is, they'll say if the means might be sinful, but if the purpose is holy, then the means becomes holy. Wow. And the Jesuits resorted, and they did this. They resorted, they resorted to all kinds of means, including murder, to accomplish what they considered to be holy ends. And they still do this in various parts of the world. The Jesuits are behind, the Jesuits are still behind the death of Protestant missionaries. Wherever they can get away with it, becomes a holy act if the result is good. This has happened to some of our missionaries in India and Mexico in the last few decades, and it's happened to various Protestant missionaries, especially in Central South America, where they can get away with it.
Jesuits now
in control of
the
Catholic Church?
Yes.
And the University of Catholic. And in part, you see that in the history of Roman Catholic literature, often the Jesuits will publish that which is not true, publish lies, in order to accomplish a holy end. So even murder and deception. Now, they're not as bad as they used to be, understand? They had to pick up their act, but they fell into disrepute all over Europe. I'm not just making this up. This is not slander. When they did it openly, in some cases, they fell into disrepute for a long time until they did have to sort of clean up. They could not be so brazen about it as they were for a while.
Did they, do you believe they possibly justified it to the public as with Old Testament precedents for God directly revealed to certain Old Testament people?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I really don't know. My bad. Well, for instance, I remember this example. When John Kennedy was running for president, there was a big hoopla about having a Roman Catholic president for Clinton. And some Protestants pointed out that the Roman Catholic dogma is that the man's first allegiance is to the Pope. That's exactly true. It's precisely true. The Jesuit Archbishop Bernardine in Baltimore published an official statement that it was not true. That if America elected a Roman Catholic president, this first allegiance would not be to the Pope, it would be to the United States Constitution. Which is a flat lie. It's just simple. All you got to do is go look it up. Understand? All documented, just a lie. Now, I think the case was moot in Kennedy's case. Now, he wasn't all anything but his glands. He was a womanizer and a. But you know, I don't think anybody had any risk of him making any decisions based on religion. His family Kennedy fortune was based on rum running during the Prohibition days, and his father-in-law was Black Jack Bouvier. The Kennedy, both Jackie and she were gangsters. They were gangsters, as that was a family background. Old Joe and his father bought their election for him in Chicago. He wasn't elected originally, and then they had a recount in Chicago, of all places, and all of a sudden he was elected. And
So anyway, I'm saying he was going to put out on the Catholics on the issue.
I'm confused as to these orders. There's Catholicism and...
These are orders of the Catholic Church.
Okay. Is there a church for the Jesuits?
No. It's not a separate church. It's an order within the church. There was a Capuchin and Augustine and Dominican. That is a
Cistercian.
All kinds of orders. But there are orders within the church. They are all over the Catholic. All swear fealty to the Pope. But Laurie, things bothering you is, listen, Laurie asked a good question when he teaches them. Many Protestants think that the Roman Catholic Church is monolithic, sort of homogeneous, it's all one in the church. And Protestantism is all divided up, which it is. But the Roman Catholic Church is much more divided than the Roman Protestantism. The Roman Catholic Church is not monolithic and never has been. That is, there's more, take the different groups and persuasions and orders within the Roman Catholic Church. There is more variety and division than there is in Protestantism. It is not monolithic. One of the reasons many people think that is the Roman Catholic Church says it is. Understand? They teach their children this. Look how divided the Protestants are. Look how united we are. Which is simply false. All you've got to do is study the church and you find that it's not monolithic at all. That is, the Jesuits spent as much energy fighting other Catholics as they did fighting Protestantism. I mean, when you get the Pope, who can outlaw an order, and can't, you know, when they become more powerful than the Pope, you got them opposing their papacy. I don't know if you all realize that or not, but it's not true that the Roman Catholic Church doesn't just have a history, just study it. I'm not slandering the church. You can study it, see for yourself. It's just not mine. You're in the right. Well, anyway, the Jesuits are still a very fearsome force. Look at their missionary activity. And they took advantage of the opening of the world, both east and west, as the European explorers began to go east and west. The Jesuits were on the ships early. And these men were very brave men. Listen to me, hundreds of Jesuits died for their faith. They were not cowards. The Jesuits would go almost where nobody else would go. And if a Jesuit missionary died, there were 10 volunteers to take his place. I was killed, you know, in a barbarian land. The Jesuits, nobody can ever accuse them of being insincere. And nobody can ever understand. We don't accept as end justifies the means business. But nobody can ever accuse them of being insincere. They were not hypocritical and they were not cowards.
Well, the Jesuits were Roman Catholic, right? So they were holding the sacrament there.
Oh, yes.
So, the mission for them would be what? Is there some people just to become Catholic?
To become Catholic. Jesuit. Kind of Catholic. Did you know? Yes.
Did they take time to teach Catholicism or did they just give a swing of the olive branch?
No, they taught it.
They taught it? So.
More than the Dominicans did. You see when they. Yes. Well, the Dominicans were the earlier educators. Of course, many of the colonies, the religious colonies in the New World were Dominican, like in San Francisco. Los Angeles, those areas, they were Dominican, but the Jesuits came along later and they were
involved. Okay, this raises a question about what we learned earlier that Francis Xavier was the leading missionary, especially in China.
He was a Jesuit.
And he converted so many, and he was a Jesuit, and they're supposed to teach, and then right along after he died, they were all converted right back within a generation. And if they were taught,
well, they were taught. Well, I mean, they were taught about as well as any is under the certain, not by our standards, but by their standards. I mean, they were taught by the standards of the day compared to the Dominican. That's a good question. Y'all see the point he raised? That's a good point. Okay. The Jesuits, the leading missionary among early Jesuits, the leading missionary was Francis Xavier, who went to the Far East, Korea, Japan in particular. Did you all see that? And where there were other missionaries, the Jesuits would disenfranchise other orders if they found them there. Did you see this TV series? Was it
was
Shogun.
Remember the scene in Shogun where the hero was in prison in Japan? And there was a Dominican priest in there who spent half his time praying to God and the other half cussing the Franciscans. Remember that, the old priest? Why? Because the why was he in jail? Because the Franciscans had him there. They gained the ear of the emperor, and they promptly got rid of the opposition, who were other Roman Catholics. And that was very true. That is historically accurate. That's exactly what they did. You understand? That is, if you were they were for the Jesuits. And if they had to get rid of, cause the death of the Dominicans, they would do that. Why? Well, they would. And justifies the means. So that was very accurate. They resorted to political intrigue, mainly through the confessional. States were influenced to disenfranchise Protestantism. They resorted to assassinations, underground propaganda efforts, and almost any other means of overthrowing Protestantism. They were behind the prosecution of the Huguenots in France. For that, the prosecution of the Huguenots was so intense, but the Jesuits were behind it. Remember, we learned that the church in France, the Protestant church in France, was called the Church of the Cross, probably more intense suffering than even the early Christians suffered under the Romans. Terrible, most terrible persecution that Protestantism in any one country has ever suffered was in France. And the Jesuits were behind it. One of the reasons, they were merciless. But they were sincere, you understand? They were sincere. Their boss didn't do it. Their boss said to kill someone, or lie, or whatever he had to do. That was Jesus speaking. They would do it instantly, without question. The second generation of the Loyola, the Jesuits, the order, was corrupted by its power, especially in high places. You see, it's very hard for people to control power. The men in charge of this had tremendous power. And power corrupts, as you know, men being what they are. Their desire for quick and spectacular results brought them into disrepute among Protestants and Catholics alike. What I'm teaching you is this, that the idea that the Jesuits, that they'll do anything, they'll murder, they'll lie, that they're behind political intrigue, that idea was not a Protestant idea. My thesis, it sounds like a non-Catholic, you know, slandering the Jesuits. What I'm saying is, but the Catholics objected on the same ground, you understand? But it was not this idea that the Jesuits would do anything and there would be fear was not a Protestant idea. It was a Catholic idea as much as they were opposed by other. Scholarship has been encyclopedic, but not creative or progressive. This is characteristic, by the way, of Roman Catholic. Now, this is changing a lot today. You'll not see this, because the Roman Catholic Church is changing in America. Who's a Roman Catholic in America? Answer anybody who says he is. The Roman Catholic Church in America is in total chaos as far as authority is concerned. Well, I mean, when you've got nuns who are pro-abortion, you know, that's pretty broad. I'll just teach you this education. The Roman Catholic, keep in mind that the soul of Roman Catholicism has been authority. Why do you believe what you believe? Because the church says it's true. Why do you believe that something is true? Because the church says it's true. This was the soul of Scholasticism. John Duns Scotus and Thomas Aquinas, you recall our discussion of that. Therefore, Roman Catholic scholarship, you see, in certain kinds of minds. As a result, Roman Catholic scholarship has been encyclopedic but not creative. That is, they are great at amassing the data. They are tremendous at that, traditionally, but not at creative thinking. Not at good, because they are under such authoritative restrictions that they're not prevented. It is the Protestant scholarship which has been more creative. You see a parallel to this, by the way, in the Japanese mind. Also, I'd say that the Roman Catholics traditionally have been very obedient. It's a part of the system.
I talked to men who were officers in the Second World War. Now, you understand, this has changed a lot now. In the Second World War, they found that, by and large, Roman Catholics made excellent soldiers and terrible officers, with many exceptions. But the Roman Catholic young man who came from New York and opened the Irish neighborhoods and the Italian neighborhoods, he put them in the lines, and they were good soldiers because they were used to doing what they were told, following orders. But when they came to making officers, as a class, though there were many fine Roman Catholic officers, as a class, they did not make as good officers because they were not used to taking responsibility. It's one thing to be trained to do what you're told, it's something else to be creative and make hard decisions and improvise. Now, I say that's changed a lot now. But even a parallel to that is the Japanese mind. The Japanese mind is encyclopedic. Japanese mind, they're very collective mind, and a very, where you obey. Japanese, you know, they don't have a juvenile mentality, very obedient, sort of a rank and file mentality. That's Japanese culture, but you don't. The Japanese. They will apply themselves assiduously to data once they, and to collecting data and organizing data. That's why the best radios and automobiles you can get are made in Japan. But all the patents are American. It's interesting that you. That the Americans are the ones, are the leaders, because America is free. America is the country that is the number one source of new ideas. Americans come up with the ideas. The Japanese produce no new ideas in technology, but they'll take ideas farther than America takes them. They'll apply those ideas more systematically. More diligently.
You can make Japan a state.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? And in fact, there's an automobile plant in Kentucky now that's adopting the Japanese approach to do it. But it's very regimented, rank and file. You operate as a group. Understand? You function as a part of the B and the D hive. See, Americans aren't conditioned to do that. Somebody talked about the marvels of Japanese technology, but Japanese technology is not Japanese, it's American and Western European. Their methods are Japanese, very Japanese. That's why they're material, that's why they're so good, you understand what I'm saying? Somebody talked about the marvels of Japanese technology, and somebody accurately said, this was said about 20 years ago, you talk about Japanese technology, you get a good transistor radio. But you talk about American technology, you get a man on the moon. Japanese could never put a man on the moon. And why do the Russians have to steal all their technology? See, all the technology that the Russians have, their space program, their weapons, is stolen from America. Why can't they create their own? The answer is that they have never known freedom. It's one mistake a lot of Americans make. They think, so surely the Russian people someday will overthrow their taskmasters and declare themselves free. The Russian people have no concept. It's one thing for a man who has been free to seek to free himself again. It's something else for a man who seeks freedom, who has no experience. Well, anyway, so the Russian mind is that regimented Prussian kind of Slavic mentality who will work hard and diligently, but they have to steal their technology from the West. And that is, did you notice this? That the Russians took the basic ideas that were developed by the Germans and the Americans, and they put the Sputnik, I remember when they flew the Sputnik, and what they did was, America had the technology, the West had the technology to do that. They just did not give the effort to do it. They just got beat in a race. But boy, that got everybody's attention. I remember, boy, all of a sudden, Kennedy declared, the space race is on. And within just a few years, America just passed Russia. It was back in the dust. And Russia was still shooting off these third-rate rockets when Neil Armstrong was walking on the moon. And the Russians never did put anybody on the moon. and the Russians are still parachuting their men back out of orbit, and we got a shuttle maybe.
So you see this, well, I didn't mean to spend as much time on this, but you see this difference in between traditionally, this is changing now because in the Western world especially, but you saw this difference between the Catholic mind and the Protestant mind. Catholic mind is more regimented. So Jesuit scholarship, listen to me, Jesuit scholarship has been systematic, intense, encyclopedic, by that it means gathering data, but you do not find creative speculative theology. You do not find new ideas. All you find is old ideas established by the authority of the church, but worked to death. It's deeded in. This is very encyclopedic. Does that make you see what I'm saying? The difference between, let me teach you the difference if you don't already understand it, but by this analogy, it takes two kinds of scholarship to write, it takes one kind of scholarship to write a good first-rate novel, like Isaac Asimov writes, and another kind of scholarship to put together the Encyclopedia Britannica. It takes more work to put the Encyclopedia together, but it's a different kind of scholarship. To edit a volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica, it takes a master's. Built on the research. Well, that's interesting to you or not, but you all are in college and you think about this. Well, their discipline and zeal, I'm reading now, their discipline and zeal beat back Protestantism and did so at the cost of the violation of the conscience of too many of them. The ethical standards of the church were lowered. That is, were the Jesuits successful in beating back and stopping the growth of Protestantism in Europe and reclaiming some Protestant lands? Yes, they were successful. But what a price they paid.
It was only temporary success, wasn't it?
No, it was permanent success in many areas. For instance, Austria.
Many areas that would have gone Protestant didn't. So they stopped the spread of Protestantism in Europe, and they reclaimed much Catholic territories. But what they did was they polarized the issue. That is, areas that had been Catholic became more Catholic, and areas that had been Protestant became more Protestant. It polarized because of the methods used by the Jesuits. Those that decided to stay Protestant were more firmly anti-Catholic than they were before. You understand? So the Jesuits served to polarize Catholicism versus Protestantism. And they did. And they what that is, some of the methods they used. There were a lot of people who were on the fence, and some who saw the Jesuit form of Catholicism and became more staunchly anti-Catholic.
Even see why. Peter Canisius, Robert Bellarmine, Aloysius Gonzaga. I remember when I was where I preached in Hamilton, Ohio, the local Catholic hospital had nurses' apartments behind the hospital.